locked behind the door. But when we finally set them free, it creaks open like a tomb. And as the stone grows right outside, the rage builds in the room. In the room.
Hello, today is Monday, May 23rd, 2011, a beautiful Victoria Day long weekend. I am Martin Lemlin, and this is CITR News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us. Good evening, it's 5:05, and time for a full hour of independent news. Today we're going to talk about the BC healthcare system, a possible strike that could affect our entire country, as well as the U.S. penal system. We've prepared a special report on the Slave Lake wildfires, and Adam Yanous has the arts report for us. We'll also have a very special gem for you today. We're going to be joined by CITR's Chief Cultural Consultant of Local Affairs, Scott Douglas. All this, plus your weekday weather forecast, right here on News 101, your source for independent local, national, and international news. But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
Battles in the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a today, where witnesses report that several government buildings have been set ablaze. The violence comes after Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh refused to sign an agreement that would have him step down from office. He said he'd only sign the agreement if opposition leaders came to the presidential palace to sign in person.
If they refuse, we will face them with all available means everywhere. And if the country goes to civil war, they will have to bear the responsibility and the bloodshed that will be everywhere.
Violence in the Pakistani city of Karachi as well, where commandos regained control of a naval base today. Taliban forces attacked the high-security compound and then occupied it for 18 hours, killing 12 security officers and destroying at least two U.S.-supplied surveillance planes. Here's Taliban spokesperson Asanala Asan, as translated by Al Jazeera's English language service.
We have two purposes in attacking this base. One is to harm the military, which is secular and supportive of the Americans, but unable to protect neither the land nor the people of Pakistan or Islam. Second, the incidents in Abbottabad and drone attacks have opened everybody's eyes. This attack is also the revenge for the killing of Sheikh Osama bin Laden. And even if we kill thousands of enemies, it will not be a sufficient revenge. Such operations will continue until our revenge is complete.
At least four Taliban members were killed in the fighting. In unrelated news, Taliban spokesmen are vigorously denying internet rumors that the movement's spiritual leader has died or been killed. Afghanistan's main intelligence service says cleric Mullah Omar has disappeared from his alleged hideout, but Western diplomats in the area say they're skeptical of reports he's been killed. The European Union has for the first time imposed sanctions on Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The movement is a response to the Assad government's crackdown on protesters, which has reportedly killed more than 900. EU Foreign Secretary Catherine Ashton.
The government needs to understand that people are asking by peaceful protest for the kind of reforms that the government has said that they're interested in. And they now ought to try and engage properly and do that.
In Israel, the civil trial over the death of American peace activist Rachel Corrie resumed yesterday with the testimony of a former Israeli army spokesperson. A bulldozer driven by an Israeli soldier crushed and killed Corrie in 2003 while she was trying to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian home in Gaza. FSRN's Gillian Kessler-Damore has more from Jerusalem.
The search for answers in the killing of Rachel Corrie continues, over 1 year after trial proceedings began in the Corrie family's lawsuit against the State of Israel in March 2010. Former Israeli Defense Forces spokesperson Ruth Yaron testified primarily about the activities of the International Solidarity Movement, the organization Corrie was volunteering with at the time of her death. According to Craig Corrie, Rachel's father, Yaron's testimony was meant to discredit the ISM.
There's no justification for killing an unarmed civilian. And I think it is incredibly strange that in this court, it would allow somebody to come in with apparently all secondhand information and try to use that to justify the killing of an unarmed peace activist.
Israeli Army Commander Pinhas Suarez was scheduled to testify as another government witness yesterday, but his testimony was postponed. Zwaretz was in charge of the Gaza Division's Southern Brigade and the bulldozer units at the time of Rachel's death. He is now expected to testify in July. Gillian Kessler-Damore, FSRN, Jerusalem.
In domestic news, the Supreme Court has just ordered what is likely to be one of the largest prisoner releases in U.S. history. A 5-4 majority upheld a court order from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, directing the state of California to cut its prison population by at least 37,000 people. At issue was whether severe overcrowding in the state prison system amounted to cruel and unusual punishment, a violation of the U.S. Constitution. The majority opinion, authored by Justice Anthony M. Kennedy, said overcrowding in California prisons had already caused suffering and death, largely because of poor access to basic health care. The decision says up to 54 prisoners share one toilet in California, as many as 200 sleep in a gymnasium. The decision leaves the state with major discretion on how to reduce its prison populations. In theory, California could pay to house some prisoners in private, out-of-state facilities rather than release them. Former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty officially entered the race for the Republican presidential nomination today. He accused President Obama of failing to tell the American people that it's not possible to fix the country's fiscal problems without making cuts.
Fluffy promises of hope and change. They don't buy our groceries, make our mortgage payments, put gas in our car, or pay for our children's school clothes or other needs.
In a poll last year, 53% of Minnesotans said they wouldn't vote for Pawlenty in a presidential race. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert for Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. You can catch their daily headlines and their full newscast. You can find that at fsrn.org. I'm going to launch right into our local headlines here, independently produced. If you were driving along the Golden Ears Bridge today, you were probably asked to pull over, not for a traffic violation or to help a distressed vehicle, but to take part in a survey. TransLink has been scoping the bridge's traffic for a few days now, asking drivers to pull over so that they can take part in a 6-to-10 question survey. Ken Hardy with the Transit Commission, or Transit Authority, says that the point of all this is to find out whether a majority of the drivers prefer paying the toll to save time or prefer avoiding the bridge to save money. Once transit has a firm grip on these statistics, an open discussion can begin regarding the attitudes towards the Golden Ears Bridge. The survey is optional, although some drivers complain that a refusal meant you'd have to wait behind a long line of automobiles to get over the bridge. The province is facing a problem where healthcare is concerned, not only in the caliber of our care, but in who's actually paying for that care. The BC government launched 8,000 lawsuits in an effort to recover healthcare costs the province has paid. The suits involve thousands of small claims against municipalities, restaurants and bars, insurance firms, and individuals. Since the Healthcare Cost Recovery Act took effect on April 1st, 2009, almost 3,000 cases have been closed, and with the province recovering over $6 million. The Cost Recovery Act obligates lawyers and insurers to notify the government whenever a lawsuit is being filed where an injured person went through BC's healthcare system. To put it simply, people are charging their hospital bills to the government when they supposedly have no right to do so. The province is also trying to work out a new care card system that would make duplication a little more difficult, because right now there are over 9 million BC care cards in circulation and a population of only about 4.5 million. So that means twice as many care cards as there are people to use them. In a minute, we're going to have the international and national headlines. You're listening to CITR 101.9 in Vancouver.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
Just fucking use you, know what I'm saying, Joe?
What is that? What is it? One more shot, a salute?
Tune in to Sore Throats and Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday evenings at 6:30 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lumlin. You'll be able to catch that gem of a show, Sore Throats, Clapping Hands, right after the news here at 6 o'clock. First, we're going to go into the international news headlines. We'll start out with let them out, just let them all out. The U.S. Supreme Court today threw their support behind an order requiring the state of California to trim the prison population by tens of thousands. The order mandates that the prison population should be brought down to roughly 110,000 inmates. Now, as of now, there are 142,000 prisoners in California's 33 adult jails. So that leaves about 32,000 inmates that will either have to be transferred to other jurisdictions or simply be released. This decision revolves around the poor health care that inmates are being provided. In 2009, California's penal system saw an average of one death a week that could have been prevented with proper medical care. The court's close 5-4 decision allows the state 2 years to lower the number of prisoners, but even by the ordered numbers, it's still overcrowded, as California's penal system is designed to accommodate only 80,000 inmates. A worker in Japan's tsunami-crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant has died, bringing the death toll at the complex to 3 since the earthquake and tsunami in March. The cause of the death is unknown. The man in his 60s was employed by one of the Tokyo Electric contractors and was working at the plant for only a day before falling ill. He was exposed to nearly 2/10 of a millisievert of radiation. Now, the Japanese government's maximum level of exposure for male workers at the plant is 250 millisieverts for the duration of the effort to bring it under control. The worker fell ill 50 minutes after starting work and was brought to the plant's medical room unconscious. He was later moved to a nearby hospital and confirmed dead, a Tokyo Electric spokesman said. Working conditions at the plant are harsh. Joshi Hisono, a special advisor to Prime Minister Naoto Kan and a ruling Democrat Party lawmaker, voiced concern about the working environments at the Fukushima complex, saying he would like to expand the efforts to improve working conditions because he's been told by several of the workers that the working environment at the plant isn't nearly good enough. The magnitude 9.0 earthquake and tsunami on March 11th triggered cooling system malfunctions at the plant and caused radiation to leak into the atmosphere and into the Pacific Ocean, and engineers are still struggling to bring the plant under control. 2 Tokyo Electric employees went missing while patrolling the plant soon after the quake and were later found dead. Yemeni loyalists face off in a gun battle that left 6 people dead today. The violence in Yemen's capital, Sana'a, erupted a day after a president backed out of a deal overseen by the Gulf Cooperation Council that called for the president's resignation. Medical officials said at least 6 people died and dozens were injured after supporters of a powerful tribal leader who sided with the anti-government protesters clashed with the police. The clashes cast further doubts on the prospect for an end to a 3-month crisis in which youth-led demonstrators, inspired by protests that toppled long-serving presidents in Tunisia and in Egypt, are demanding an end to the president's nearly 33-year rule. And in national news, it looks as though mail will continue to be delivered in a routine manner. There were talks that Canada Post workers might go on strike as early as tomorrow, but that threat has been put off, if not entirely extinguished. The union representing urban postal workers presented a contract proposal yesterday that supposedly included important compromises that are unresolved, things like wage benefits and staffing levels and working conditions. It should be stressed that a settlement has not been reached, and Canada Post is only saying that negotiations are still in progress. Now, postal workers were expected to give a 72-hour notice of strike yesterday. And the lack of a notice effectively means that postal workers could strike no earlier than Friday. A pilot has been injured in a helicopter crash east of Slave Lake today. The man's injuries are non-life-threatening, according to Captain Al Baldry of CFB Trenton. The chopper was not involved in the firefighting efforts in northern Alberta, and a spokesman with the Canadian Forces said it was not a military aircraft either. Air and ground ambulances are dispatched to the scene of the crash in Calling Lake, about 100 kilometers east of Slave Lake. The pilot was brought to the University of Alberta, Hospital to treat his injuries. The nature of the crash is not clear at this point. And this comes about 3 days after a pilot died when his helicopter went down in the waters of Lesser Slave Lake while fighting the wildfires. The helicopter was in the process of scooping water from the lake when the chopper veered into its side and crashed into the lake. 12 firefighters jumped in to try and save the pilot, but conditions simply wouldn't allow it. All 12 men were treated for hypothermia and exposure to jet fuel. The helicopter was owned by Campbell Helicopters Limited of Abbotsford, BC, and was privately contracted by Alberta Resource Development to help battle the fires. This is the only death linked to wildfires so far this year. For more on the developing situation in Slave Lake, we have a report that looks into the situation itself, as well as a town hall meeting that was held last night for the residents of Slave Lake, 250 of whom will have gotten their first chance to see what's left of the town in the first of two scheduled bus tours through the fire-ravaged community. Today, a few hundred Slave Lake citizens have a chance to take a bus tour of their fire-ravaged town. The tours have been limited to people over the age of 18, with preference given to those who have definitively lost their homes. The wildfires that started in Slave Lake on May 15th have destroyed roughly 450 homes and businesses, including the town hall, library, as well as nearly half the houses in the small community in northern Alberta. Last night, some of the residents, the 7,000 people of Slave Lake who evacuated their homes, convened at a town hall meeting in Athabasca to talk about the state of the fires, the firefighting effort, today's bus tour, and when the residents will be allowed back into their town to start rebuilding the community. Brian McCasey, the information officer from the Calgary Fire Department, fielded questions from the people of Slave Lake in an attempt to clarify just what it is that the firefighters are dealing with.
We're searching for hidden fires, we're putting them out, and I just want to take some time here to explain the process. What happens is they dig out that rubble, we take that rubble up, and what we do is we're putting out the fire as it's being removed. It's in the truck. And by the way, one of the trucks last night, although we did a thorough effort, it actually caught on fire in the truck on the way to the place where it was to be collected. Once it's removed, it has to be wetted down again. It is an extremely extensive, difficult operation. And again, we're not dealing with things that are charred or ashen or things that you have to make a decision about whether it's of value or not. We're talking about things that are utterly destroyed.
Right now, there are 44 wildfires in Alberta. 8 of them are out of control, 10 are being held, and 26 are either under control or have been turned over, which is to say they are no longer threatening to flare up. 4 fires within the district of Slave Lake are considered to be out of control and have burned 4,559 hectares, which is nearly 50 square kilometers. What helps to make wildfires so dangerous and unpredictable is their ability to travel underground. There might not be flames, but the heat is so intense that it only takes a small gust of wind to flare an area up. RCMP Corporal Carol McKinley gave residents some specifics regarding the situation in Slave Lake.
When they were addressing one site, they could actually feel heat. And so when they did a measurement of the heat of the peat moss near the basement, it was 140 degrees Celsius. So they could actually feel the heat surrounding them.
So now firefighters are digging up dirt. Aside from actually trying to back the blaze away from the town, firefighters have to search underground, looking for hot spots and fires that are actually burning below the earth's surface and in people's basements. Brian McCasey addressed how these intense underground fires, as well as the initial wildfire, have affected the homes and, in essence, the earthly possessions of the people of Slave Lake.
The overhaul that we're doing, the search for those hidden fires in those basements, I want to make sure that you're absolutely clear what I mean by places that are destroyed. When I went there, and I've been to many, many of your properties, and when I go there, what I am seeing and what we've seen, they're not half-burned teddy bears. They're not pieces of furniture that you can sort of make distinctions of. There is complete incineration. And so, just to be absolutely clear, it is almost impossible to see something that is man-made within that the debris. What we have is spalled concrete, concrete that was so hot, it literally came apart in these basements. What we have in these basements, the few that we found, in the one block I was in, we found four safes. And these safes are fireproof safes. They were destroyed. They were opened up. There was nothing in them, like they had been cracked open by the heat.
All of this is hardly being considered consoling information for those who are anxiously waiting to go back home, but firefighters and officials maintain that the area is simply too dangerous, and that it will be at least another week before residents will be allowed back into Slave Lake. For now, 250 people will take a bus tour, both today and tomorrow. In the town hall, McCasey told those in attendance what they can expect as they crawl through their decimated town in the safety of a school bus.
I know this is impossible for you to believe, and you believe it from me, like right now, but I want you to tomorrow, when you're on that tour, if you can see it, the destruction, when I say is almost complete, it is devastating, it is unprecedented, it's something I've never seen before. These items are incinerated, and your property is sacrosanct, sir, and there are a lot of things being done to make sure that anything that is salvageable is being looked after, and the RCMP officer I'm with right now can speak to that. But I just want to emphasize, and I know this is incredible to believe because you've seen pictures of some things in between houses, bikes that are still there, you've seen the odd item that's been collected. I'm telling you, these are extremely rare, and what we're dealing with is utter destruction of that property. And I hate to say that to you, and I know some of you will not believe it, but that is the truth.
As residents look upon their ruined homes from bus windows, it'll be inevitable that they're overcome by a tidal wave of emotion. But one thought will surely be entering the minds of those who have lost their homes. Where will I stay when we're allowed back in? It's a difficult situation to put yourself in, the struggle of actually having to rebuild your home. The term starting over from scratch just doesn't do justice to the uphill battle these people will face in the coming months, even years. Slave Lake Mayor Karina Pilokine told those at the town hall meeting of the plans that the municipality is considering for those who have lost their homes.
So I know many are concerned who've lost their homes or homes that are damaged. We have a huge task force identifying a specific plan of providing housing for those who don't have homes. So we're, as far as what the structures are going to look like, where they're going to be, I don't have those details, but we have a team that's going to be providing housing, so when you come home, you're going to have a place to stay.
There's another bus tour planned for tomorrow, so in all, 500 residents will have a chance to take in the remnants of their town. Until the area is safe enough to re-enter, the only thing the people of Slave Lake can do is hope and plan for the future. In the wake of this disaster, there will inevitably be some sort of scrutiny surrounding the tactics with which the fire was fought. How did it get out of hand so quickly? What could have been done differently? But now is not the right time for that. There are over 2,000 firefighters in Alberta right now, 500 of which are from BC and Ontario. There are 140 helicopters, 32 air tankers, and scores of heavy ground equipment. A treasure chest of resources are being poured into making the district of Slave Lake livable once more. And McCasey insists nothing in our power could have been done to avoid this disaster.
I just want to say, if Calgary Fire Department, if our 1,400 men and women were lined up on that road, you told us it was coming, we had every apparatus ready to go, we could not have stopped that fire. It was unprecedented, it was unstoppable. And it, I mean, and we can quibble over what could have, like, you know, how we could have done it a little differently, but within minutes, these people, like, they're, you would have been overwhelmed, any department, any city, any place would have been overwhelmed. It would have been impossible to have mount a proper, any sort of reaction. And so you guys did, I got to tell you, I can't believe they did as well as they did. Like, it's unbelievable that no one was killed. It's unbelievable that no one was injured. It's unbelievable that they were able to stop it like they did.
Our thoughts are with the people of Slave Lake, as well as the men and women doing their best to restore calm within this community. The forces of nature are immense, often beyond our comprehension. What we can take away from this catastrophe is impossible to tell now. Only in hindsight will we be able to find meaning and context. But for now, we can look at the very shady bright side. That this horrible experience will inevitably strengthen the fiber that weaves the people of Slave Lake together. CITR will continue to bring you the latest information regarding these fires, but for the most part, the deal seems to be done. The residents will be faced with a daunting task of rebuilding their town, and they'll be better because of it, more than we can possibly imagine. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lemlin.
That was Martin Lemlin with the great segment on the Slave River Lake fires. And now we go to a commercial, PSAs, and you're listening to CITR 11.9 FM, broadcasting from the Student Union Building at UBC right here in Vancouver.
The North by Northeast Festival, music, film, and interactive, takes over Toronto once again June 13th to 19th. North by Northeast showcases the best new music from around the world. Rock, hip-hop, punk, country, blues, electronica, singer-songwriter, and more. It's your chance to catch breakout performances from tomorrow's stars. 7 days, 50 stages, over 650 bands, plus 40 great music-related films. All this for just $50. Wristbands are on sale. Check nxne.com for details. Also available, passes that get you into the clubs first and into North by Northeast's groundbreaking interactive media conference. You want more? North by Northeast also rocks the heart of Toronto with 4 nights of massive free outdoor concerts. Visit nxne.com for tickets and up-to-the-minute festival info. North by Northeast, celebrating 17 years of great music.
Welcome back to CITR 11.9 FM. You're listening to News 101. I'm your host, Iqbal Ahmed. And now we go to a special segment from Free Speech Radio News on the controversial Rafah crossing, which connects Egypt and Palestine.
In late April, Egyptian officials announced they would permanently open the Rafah border crossing, allowing more freedom of movement for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. But nearly a month later, restrictions are still in place. FSRN's Rami Almagari reports.
The Rafah crossing terminal in southern Gaza Strip is used by patients, students, and people with residency permits in nearby Arab countries. Before the Egyptian revolution, these people were allowed to cross through the Rafah terminal and enter Egypt. But over the last 3 months, authorities have turned many of them back.
Yes, Abu Nabil, I am turned back, brother. I am turned back. Bye.
70-year-old Saleh Zurub holds Egyptian nationality papers, but border agents have denied him entry today and each of the last 7 times he has tried to cross, saying it's because of state security.
My children are Egyptians, my grandchildren are Egyptians, my daughters are Egyptians, my brothers are Egyptians, and my father, may he rest in peace, is an Egyptian. Just look, please, at these papers, this Egyptian court ruling proving my Egyptian nationality. I want to go there to obtain my Egyptian passport. I just need 3 days to get there.
Another Gaza traveler is Mohammed al-Najjar, a 48-year-old seeking medical treatment. On Sunday, for the second time in 2 weeks, Egyptian authorities turned him away. His attempts to leave Gaza through Israel's border were also unsuccessful.
I need a surgery in my eyes in Jordan. I have a visa to Jordan and referral papers, including financial coverage from the Palestinian Authority, though I was prevented from crossing. They don't give you a clear-cut response. They only tell you that it is related to the state security apparatus, and they say you should wait until the state security personnel are back to work.
Last Thursday, Palestinian staff on the Gaza side of the terminal suspended their work for 1 day, protesting the Egyptian restrictions. Palestinian officials say that each day, Egyptian authorities deny entry to dozens of people trying to cross the border. Salama Baraka of the ruling Hamas party in Gaza is in charge of the crossing. He told FSRN that the Egyptian side has promised to ease those restrictions, including increasing the number of travelers allowed into Egypt each day and expanding the categories of authorized travelers, but he hasn't seen those promises put into action.
Let me please tell you that we have been maintaining a goodwill relationship with the Egyptian side at both the personal and professional levels. But unfortunately, such a relationship has not served the Palestinian citizens. We hope that the Egyptian decision makers will open the Rafah crossing terminal completely and without restrictions or conditions.
The former regime of the toppled Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak kept the Rafah crossing terminal closed for most travelers from June 2007 until January 2009, right after the Israeli war on Gaza. Since January 2009, Egyptian authorities have allowed more regular openings of the crossing, but Gazans and their supporters say Egyptian officials should make good on their promises. Rami Al-Mighari, Afasaran, Gaza.
Thanks to FSRN for that. We're now going to throw things to Iqbal Ahmed for our weekly weather forecast.
Thank you, Martin. Weather this week looks like tonight, cloudy periods becoming cloudy near midnight, 30% chance of showers overnight with a low of 9. Tuesday, cloudy with 30% chance of showers early in the morning, clearing late in the morning, high 17, UV index of 5 or moderate. Tuesday night, cloudy periods becoming cloudy over midnight, low 11. Wednesday, period of rain, high of 15. Thursday, cloudy with 60% chance of showers, low of 11, high of 15. Friday, cloudy with 70% chance of showers, low of 11, high of 14. Saturday, cloudy with 60% chance of showers, low of 9, high of 15. And Sunday, cloudy with 30% chance of showers, low of 9, high of 16. And that's your weekday weather forecast provided to us by Environment Canada. Back to you, Martin.
Thank you very much, Iqbal. That was a heck of a weather report. We now have something very, very special for you. It's actually a first for CITR News 101. I'm joined by CITR's News' expert consultant on cultural matters with specialties in the Canucks and miscellaneous affairs, as well as our chief professional falconer, Scott Douglas. Scott, can you hear me? Scott?
Yes, sir. Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, how are you today?
I'm surprisingly not unwell, thank you. And how do you find yourself this afternoon?
About the same, but you can't really ask for more on the most days.
No, you can't. And if you do, you'll just be beaten and left to bleed out.
Yeah.
So, Martin, I want to go off on these Canucks. Remember these Vancouver Canucks?
Yes, I think I remember them.
That lousy bunch of bums that had just lost three straight games to their evil arch nemesis Chicago Blackhawks, only to triumph with the overtime heroics of tenacious Alex Burrows giving them the victory in decisive Game 7.
Yeah, rings a bell.
Then we had the Sedin sisters, my boss likes to call them. He gave BC the screaming heebie-jeebies when they couldn't get it going against the plucky yet outmatched Nashville Predators. But now this Canucks team and its leaders are back in a big way. Oh boy, I don't know if you watched it, but they sure showed it yesterday afternoon in San Jose. That 4-2 win puts the Canucks one win away from a berth in the Stanley Cup Finals for the first time since 1994, and they have some lazy San Jose penalties and sharp special teams to thank.
Yeah, I know. I watched the game. It was one heck of a match. Did you happen to see that?
Yeah, for about a minute straight there, hey?
Yeah, about that much.
May I have a report here on the Canucks I'd like to read, if I may.
Oh, you certainly can.
All right, put your feet up, sir.
All right.
We'll get to this little lady in a second, but in a series dominated by special teams play, this game was no different, with nearly 15 of the first 33 minutes being spent with the team on the power play. That's where the Canucks dominated in a turnabout from their 4-3 loss in Game 3. Now, in that game, they allowed three power play goals and failed to convert during nearly 2 minutes of 5-on-3 time in the second period. This game was different, as the Canucks solved both of those issues, despite missing defenseman Christian Ehrhoff, who got smoked by Jamie McGinn in Game 3, and defenseman Aaron Rome, who was also forced by that same Jamie McGinn to eat a big chunk of glass. Now, McGinn wasn't penalized, by the way, which I think is becoming a little bit of a trend, not suspending guys who have really done some damage, because losing a player like Jamie goddamn McGinn is really going to affect your chances so much, right? Pardon me, but I mean, holy crap, the guy gets sent out by Todd McClellan to take a run at one of our best defensemen. he gets away with it. So later in the game, he takes a run at one of our worst defensemen. I don't know. But that all that Game 2 Ben Eager nonsense, first with the head of every NHL disciplinary body in attendance and no suspension, now McGinn tries to hospitalize our entire blue line. I think the punishment should fit the crime, and then Ehrhoff should get to take a run at McClellan, or tell someone to, not on the ice. Maybe while he's trying to conduct an interview after he's fired because another Sharks team collapsed in the conference finals, which is sad because it won't really be his fault. The Sharks just keep losing to better teams. But if McClellan tells another player to intentionally injure another Canuck, he should at least get punched in the back of the head while he's taking a nice hot sip of coffee, as you know is my preferred punishment.
Well,
so first off, the Canucks killed five straight minor penalties to open the game as they spent 10 of the first 25 minutes shorthanded. The Sharks, who converted on their first five power play chances in the series. 5 for 5. 100% chance they were going to score on the power play, and they got shut down. They struggled to set up in the offensive zone, and when they did get in the Vancouver end, Luongo was there to make pretty solid-looking saves. Now, the Canucks' work on the penalty kill paid off in a big way in the second period when the Sharks were called for four minor penalties in just under 3 minutes to lead to a huge scoring outburst. With Danny Heatley already in the box for high sticking, Torrey Mitchell got called for hooking to give Vancouver its first of 3 2-man advantages. The Canucks took a mere 10 seconds to convert, with Kessler beating Antti Niemi with a one-time slap shot from the circle. Just a minute 23 later, a heads-up play by Henrik Sedin. Tricky play, actually. Henrik Sedin throws the puck up the ice to the extra Shark skater coming off the bench, and he's just helpless. Takes the pass, and it's all of a sudden too many men penalty. 16 seconds later, there's a 2-0 Canucks lead. Now, then, next face-off, like the drunken stumble bum he is, San Jose defenseman Douglas Murray chips the puck over the glass for another delay of game call. 10 seconds later, Salo loads another one up from the point, and it's 3-0 Canucks. That did it. That did it for the Sharks. It killed them. It probably finished their season. It was business as usual for the Canucks after that. They've been tops in the NHL all year at locking down third-period leads. All Henrik Sedin had to do for the rest of the game was make a really sick pass to Alex Burrows right through the goalie's legs, and that was it. Game over. 4-0. Oh, yeah. And Rafi Torres absolutely smoked down Joe Thornton, who now has a shoulder injury and will probably play hurt tomorrow night. Now, this brings me to the part of the show. I don't know if you're familiar with this, Martin. You're not always hosting this, but this is Scooter McDougall's Hercules of the Game Award.
You don't say.
Yeah. Now, this is given out to whoever or whomever I see fit. Now, this week, the award goes to, we got the drum roll effect. Yeah. Rafi Torres for injuring Jumbo Joe Thornton. Now, God love him, Rafi Torres. He didn't do much else in this game, but he hit Joe Thornton with an honest shoulder-to-shoulder hit that Big Joe just didn't see coming. So congratulations, Rafi Torres. You're Scooter McDougall's Hercules of the game. Or for those of you Greeks out there, Heracles of the game. So, Rafi, you can swing by CITR later on any weeknight or even-numbered day where the preceding Monday has been a holiday, or just give me a call and I'll have my Purolator guy deliver your prize. And you might be asking yourself, Rafi, what did you win? Well, Rafi, if you've ever experienced plain breadless chicken, your problems are at an end. Shake and Bake, in association with the good folks at Lilydale Chicken Farms, have donated this lovely coupon book containing up to $37 in savings when you purchase Shake and Bake and Lilydale Chicken at any local Safety Mart Foods location. So congratulations again, Rafi Torres.
That is some prize, Scott.
That's a heck of a haul there, eh?
Although I must say that is a shameless sponsor bashing you just put into our what was once an immaculate newscast.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, hey, you can't make an omelet without breaking a couple eggs, though, right?
That is true. Truer words were never spoken. Thanks for your insight. Right. You have some pretty wild ideas there.
Yeah, thank you. I should note here, now just wrapping up on the Canucks here, and it's lovely that Torres has won this prize and everything, but it should be noted that never in their entire 40-year history, through all the failures, the smattering of small triumphs, never, ever have the Canucks lost a Game 5 of the Western Conference Finals.
Really? Well, that's only happened once before.
Or the Campbell Conference Finals, for that matter.
So they're 1-0 in Games 5 in the Western Conference Finals.
Two?
Oh, my mistake.
Yeah.
Well, history.
No big deal. we'll see tomorrow night, though, right? Puck drop for the next game, tomorrow night, 6 o'clock, Rogers Arena. But that's not the sports you wanted to hear about. I know that. Everybody knows that.
No,
I've got another sports story here. May I?
You may.
You've all been waiting to hear about the result of Team Canada and their latest game at the World Indoor Lacrosse Championship in Prague.
Oh, yes, of course.
You probably know already. I'm preaching to the choir here, but here's what happened. Defenseman, stalwart, Rory Smith scored his first goal in 7 years as Canada hammered us. Where do you get that stat? Lacrosse stats, unbelievable. First goal in 7 years as Canada hammered Australia 26-2 at our national sport. It was Smith's first goal since he played with a junior B team in Toronto, and it helped Canada improve to 2-0 at the tournament. Two other Canadians scored 5 goals each. A couple guys got hat tricks. Unbelievable. Almost everybody scored except for the goalie. Tyler Richards let in the 2 goals, and Anthony Cosmo went the rest of the way. Canada wraps up round-robin play in its pool Tuesday against England. That'll decide who finishes first and gets a bye into Friday's semifinals. Now, I say bring on the Americans, because it's clearly, it's another one of those two-team leagues, you know?
Oh, yes, yes. The battle.
Now, Martin, I know you're probably, I don't know if you can hear her here, but you were going to ask me about Mephistopheles.
Yes, I understand that aside from your wide breadth of expertise as it is, you're adding falconing to your repertoire.
Well, I wish I was adding it, but I am a full-time falconer. Now, you would describe me as a beginner, but that's only because of the breed of Mephistopheles here. Now, she's a 3-year-old red-tailed hawk.
Yeah.
And I got her from a breeder by the name of Stepan van de Golik. Now, he runs the Falcon Tree, a falcon and hawk breeding ranch out on a beautiful piece of property by Salmon Arm.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of the place.
I've prepared for you, if we have time, a small demonstration of Mephistopheles' hunting prowess.
Well, we do have an arch support to get to, but I'm sure Mephistopheles
all right,
will
well,
wow
just
us.
Very quickly then, I'll remove the hood, and I'll gently release her from my arm, and she's soaring away very gracefully. She is hungry. She'll be in search of food. She should be back very shortly. I've been waiting for this interview all afternoon, so she's quite hungry. I hope I don't have to explain to another poodle owner why my over-raptor has brutalized their dog, hey?
Well, it's bound to happen.
You of all people know the stories I could tell about this raptor slaughtering tiny, ridiculous dogs.
Oh, I've heard one or two of them, yes.
So while Mephistopheles is out hunting, I'd like to just take 1 second to bring up something very near and dear to my heart, because you said we had time. A persecuted group of individuals, which I'm very proud to be a member. Yes, I'm speaking of erotic falconers. Yes, erotic falconers. I implore you to check out our homepage. It's got some pictures and some basic frequently asked questions. It's eroticfalconry.com. There's a small catalog of photos of the types of things erotic falconry entails. And a quick shout-out to the sponsors, Boat Mart, Jumpy Time Magic Castles, Mitch Gage, Cutting Edge Professional Solution, and, of course, Pumpkinville. Here comes Mephistopheles. She's coming back.
And
there
what is
she
it
is
that she
in
has?
The distance. Closer. She has some prey. Oh, it looks like a small... Oh, it's a squirrel. It's a dirty old squirrel. Well, as you can see, Mephistopheles, the red-tailed hawk, is just like her namesake, a German iteration of the devil, which brought darkness and despair upon denizens of the ground from high above.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Scott. I'm going to have
You're
to let you go.
You're welcome. Thanks. That's all I really have time for, too. I better get these souffles in the oven. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Mark.
That was absolutely outstanding. Thank you.
Right. I'll talk to you later.
Yes.
Good day.
Now, that was CITR's news expert consultant on cultural matters with specialties in the Canucks and miscellaneous affairs, Scott Douglas. Right now, we're going to go to an arts report. We're going to give it to Mr. Yanus for his arts report, because this week Adam is taking a look at a modern adaptation of the classic Shakespeare play Macbeth. This play was actually translated from an old German version, and Vancouver's lucky enough to be able to take in the show. And here's the arts report with Adam Yanus.
Heart Theatre are putting on Macbeth, which they describe as an age-old story of state terror and avarice. Nice. But that's not all. They're using a German adaptation of the original called Macbeth nach Shakespeare by Heiner Müller, arguably one of the most important dramatists of the 20th century. He's adapted several of Shakespeare's works, but the thing is, he wrote it all in German, which is not very useful for us. So director Quinn Harris hired a colleague of Mueller's, Carl Weber, highly accomplished in his own right, to translate it, and now Macbeth nach Shakespeare will be presented in the English language for the first time ever. That's quite a feat. Just ask Michael Schaller Jr., who plays the lead role.
It's very exciting. Heiner Müller is considered one of the greatest German artists to come out of the 20th century, probably second only to Brecht and maybe his wife, Helen Weigel. And so that great piece, his adaptation of Macbeth, has been translated into French, and it's been produced a few times in French and in German, but this is the first time ever it'll be produced in English. In fact, our very smart and ambitious director, Quinn Harris, went directly to Carl Weber, the dramaturg of Heiner Müller and former dramaturg of Bertolt Brecht, and asked him if he had a translation, an English translation of Macbeth. And Carl had said, no, I've translated all of his other works, Hamlet Machine and Titus, and all of Heiner Müller's great works, but he has not translated Macbeth yet. So he decided to translate it for us. So this is a new script that we're lucky enough to get to premiere.
So this is, you're making history then?
I suppose so. We're making theater history here awesome. In Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
Okay, now let me ask you this. What's wrong with the original Macbeth that it required redoing?
Nothing's wrong with it, but as Heiner Müller says, there's something wrong with our current theater oeuvre if all of our plays are written by Shakespeare and are slaves to Shakespeare. So originally Müller had set out to actually write a translation of Shakespeare, and the first production was billed as such. But along the way, he discovered there were things he wanted to change. Themes he took out, themes he put in, bits of poetry more suited to the feeling of Berlin during that time, separated by the wall. So he interlaced a lot of Cold War undertones and found political hierarchies that he could highlight and perhaps remove as well to serve his purpose at the time. So it wasn't that we felt Shakespeare is broken, it's that Müller felt he needed to use Shakespeare as a vehicle to tell the story he wanted to tell at that time, and now it's being translated back so we can see what Müller has done and also find how it's relevant today here in Canada.
Well, let me ask you that. Is it relevant today in Canada?
Well, I don't think Harper's actually killed anyone to get to where he is.
Not yet.
But Macbeth and our Prime Minister are both ambitious fellows who like to quash opposition.
Right.
So I think there's going to be a universality to this story whenever it's told. It's about the ambition of a man who is so driven for power and so manipulated or convinced by his wife and seduced by his very passionate wife to take the crown by dishonest means. I think we all can relate to Macbeth. We all have to decide, are we going to take the short immoral path to a quick success or tread the path of decency and hope that rewards will benefit that lifestyle choice.
Now I understand this version is also funny. How does that work?
Yeah, well, I actually think the original is quite funny. I mean, not slapstick throughout, sure. But there is a certain amount of humor, especially in the Porter scene, juxtaposed right after the brutal murder of right. Duncan. All of a sudden, this Porter comes out drunk as a skunk and has this clownish monologue where he riffs on about whether they're in heaven and hell and puns about sex. And so that's very much in the original. And I think it's some of that dark humor is furthered and highlighted here. There's a new sense of separation, a real class warfare separating the peasants and the lords and the royalty in this version. And so the peasants seem to have a real from the hip way of speaking that is very humorous and fun and irreverent and kind of pulls the rug out from underneath the very grave and serious lords and royals.
Now tell me about the role of Macbeth. It's quite an athletic role. There's a lot of ups and downs. What are you noticing? What are you finding about doing this role?
I'm finding that it's challenging me. It's pulling me in all sorts of directions, and it plagues my dreams. And I think my wife will be happy when the show is over. I think I'm a little more dark and brooding than I am normally. I feel like when I come to rehearse the show, I run a marathon every day.
Yeah.
And when I perform the show, I'm going to be running a marathon nightly and sometimes two times a day. So it really taxes you to go to those places, as you said, the ups and the downs. And Macbeth really does struggle and wrestle with his decisions. He's not just a villain who does things without justification. He is wrestling all the way down to his descent into hell and trying to find, at least at the first half, trying to find a reason for, a moral reason for doing what he does. And so that wrestling match I do with myself and with the other actors and characters in this play are very taxing on the body. So
yeah.
I find that I'm quite wiped out at the end of the day, to say honestly.
Well, that's great. Now, we've quickly run out of time. Is there anything else you'd want to mention?
No, I just think this is going to be a really unique production, and there's not going to be another production like this in Vancouver. Mueller is rarely done in this country, and I think he should be discovered in Vancouver, and I think those who love Shakespeare will get new insight into Shakespeare if they come out and see this. It's not going to be their standard fare. But they'll recognize the story and recognize the characters. People that come along with their script in hand, hoping to read every single line of the Bard's poetry, will notice some huge changes, some small changes. Huh. But hopefully our production will make converts of them all.
Wow, that's great. Well, we're very excited. Thanks so much for taking some time to tell us about it.
My pleasure, Adam.
That's Michael Scholar, and he's talking about Macbeth nach Shakespeare, and that's coming to Performance Works on Granville Island from May the 20th until May the 29th, 8 p.m., with weekend matinees at 2 p.m., and tickets range from $15 to $25, and you can get them from tickets tonight.ca or at the door, though keep in mind, at the door, it is cash only. You can get more information on their website, which is an awesome website. It is just conspiracy.ca.
And thank you for that segment, Adam.
All right. That's our program for today, May 23rd, 2011. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334. And I'm proud to say that our message box is newly open and not congested. Or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter at the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at CITR.ca. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. And stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Scarred in battles waged, and allies on a victory. March, about to be engaged, and as they try to navigate the wreckage and the fumes, they'll all wind up here soon enough as the rage builds in the room, in the room. Swollen hearts and sympathies when pushes turn to blows. Little songs and symphonies, they're struggling to be composed.